Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Elizabeth Anderson has emerged as one of the leading philosophers of our time. She's the chair of the philosophy department at the University of Michigan. She's called a leading theorist of democracy and social justice. And in particular, she's pushing us to think about equality and freedom in new ways. Now, the two values have traditionally been in somewhat of a tension. Some limits on personal freedom are seen to be needed to increase equality. But Anderson looks past abstraction and to real-world problems, to history, social science, and economics. And she's building a case that we have equality and freedom all wrong, that they're not in tension, that equality is actually the foundation of a free society. And in a recent profile in The New Yorker, the magazine said that bringing together ideas from both the left and the right, quote, Anderson may be the philosopher best suited for this moment in American life. So this hour On Point, rethinking freedom and equality with Elizabeth Anderson. And you can join us. How do you see freedom and equality? Do you see the two values as coexisting or perhaps in tension? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook through On Point Radio. Now, joining us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Elizabeth Anderson. She's the John Dewey Distinguished University Professor of Philosophy and Women's Studies at the University of Michigan. She's the chair of the philosophy department there. And as I mentioned, she was recently profiled in The New Yorker. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Elizabeth Anderson, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more about what you have to say about freedom and equality, or liberty and equality, as the bases of the society we live in. But I was wondering if you could just actually start by telling us a story, or the story, of when it was in your own life that you first started really thinking about these two values. What had happened to you?
You know, I've been thinking about them for an incredibly long time. Even in high school, these were things I was thinking about in the turbulent 1970s, when you had protests over the Vietnam War, and I lived through the civil rights movement as a young child. So these issues of freedom and equality have really been at the top of my mind for a really, really long time. But let me tell you a story that really struck me. One of my first jobs when I was in college, a summer job I took at a bank in Harvard Square. I was just visiting in Cambridge. And at the time, I was a really confirmed capitalist, mm-hmm. libertarian, total believer in free markets and private property. But I was in this bank and I was a bookkeeper. My job was to bounce checks. So we would get in the morning, all the bookkeepers would get their list of checks and check out who was overdrawn. And then we would have a manager come in who would tell us, well, which checks would be paid and which wouldn't, and who would get a fine and who would not have to pay a fine. And I noticed certain patterns. One really prominent pattern was that employers would always bounce the workers' paychecks. They would never bounce the checks that they owed to their suppliers. The workers would be depositing their paychecks. Those checks would bounce, and they would have to pay a fine. Mm-hmm. But wealthier people didn't have to pay a fine, and sometimes even the bank would pay their overdrawn account. And that was before we had standard arrangements now for overdrafts. They didn't have them in those days. It was all an ad hoc decision. And I saw this systematic unfairness, especially against these workers who had already put in all of their work and weren't paid and then had to effectively extend a loan to their employer and pay a fee to the bank,
right,
for extending that loan. And that really got me to thinking about maybe there are systematic unfairness in the way our system operates. Mm-hmm.
And so how then in that moment, or maybe from that moment, did you start questioning this notion that or asking the question of, are we seeing how these the values of freedom and equality, are we seeing how those values come together in American life in the wrong way? I mean, do you think they're coming together in the wrong way?
Well, what I was thinking was the employer is thinking, well, I've got a lot of freedom here to decide who I pay. But that came at the cost of the workers' freedom.
Right.
And at the same time, there was also a profound inequality here. There was a reason why the employer was ripping off the workers who are their subordinates and not their suppliers to whom they were beholden. So what was pretty clear was that in this case, inequality and unfreedom came hand in hand. The people at the bottom both had to take orders and suffer various indignities. That's a kind of inequality. And in virtue of that inequality, they were unfree. And so my thought was, well, that suggests that to enable workers to be free, they needed a kind of equality. So, and in general, I think that's true about social relationships.
I mean, one's first reaction might be, this sounds like a youthful swing from capitalism to Marxism.
Ah, but no, I was never Marxist. So, and I think there's just a lot of awful things wrong with Marxist theory. And when I was in college, in fact, I took some courses in radical political economy and I was fighting the professors every step of the way. There's a lot of things. You know, Marx was wrong about history. He was wrong about how you could create a free society through revolution. In reality, what revolution brought was the most ruthless and oppressive people to power, and they just reconstructed, an oppressive system with them at the top. So that didn't really work out well for anyone. And the abolition of free markets didn't really work out very well in the Soviet Union or in China or any other place. So in fact, a lot of my thinking has been, okay, we need markets, we need private property, but how can we reconfigure those institutions so as to promote a free society of equals, a society in which people are equal and free?
Okay, so I want to, a little later in the show, I want to explore that with you. But maybe perhaps we should just take a second here to hear what your basic definitions are for freedom and equality. When you talk about equality, what exactly do you mean?
So one clear way to think about equality is in terms of its opposite, with inequality. And a fundamental form of inequality is social relations of domination and subordination. That's where the dominant people get to order the subordinates around or treat them with impunity in various ways without being held to account. That's a relation of domination. And the subordinates not only are unequal in that relationship, but they're also unfree.
Uh-huh.
So there you can see the inequality and the unfreedom coming together.
But can you have hierarchies? So essentially, but are you saying that there should be no hierarchy, or there can be a hierarchy with accountability?
Well, that's exactly the idea. So it turns out that in any large-scale organization, you need some kind of hierarchy of offices. I'm chair of my department, so right, I'm a little bit higher up than my colleagues. Not that my colleagues sometimes don't envy me for that, because it gives me a lot of responsibilities that for dealing with bureaucracy when they would much rather be dealing with interesting ideas. But any large scale organization is going to have some kind of hierarchy. But the question is whether the people higher up are accountable, so that they can't treat subordinates with impunity, and so that subordinates have channels for complaint, feedback, and redress of grievances.
Right.
And if you have that, then you can still have basic equality by strictly limiting the powers of office holders, higher office holders, strictly to their functions. Mm-hmm. So there are certain functions I have as chair of the department. I have various responsibilities, but my powers can't extend beyond what I need to discharge my responsibilities.
Right. So what I read from your work thus far, and as the New Yorker wrote about you, is that you're asking us, and this may be a particular challenge in America, but you're asking us to sort of reframe our notions of liberty or freedom and equality away from the individual, right? And really think about what freedom and equality mean at a societal level. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I think we have to think, and this is difficult for most Americans, but we have to think structurally and not just in terms of what's in it for me. Because it's really large-scale social structures that determine the opportunities within which any individual can operate. So you should ask not just of the opportunities I have, am I free to choose this one or that one? But ask the bigger question, well, why do I only have these opportunities and not others? That's the large-scale question that I want to focus our attention on. And that requires us to come to grips with the fact that different groups in society actually have dramatically different opportunities that for the less advantaged groups put them into situations of subordination and stigmatization, various kinds of inequality that are also forms of unfreedom.
Yeah. So we'll pick up on that thought and explore it more when we come back. We're speaking today with Elizabeth Anderson. She is the chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Michigan. She was recently profiled in the New Yorker as the philosopher redefining equality and perhaps the philosopher best suited to address the inequalities of our time. Elizabeth Anderson is also author of a number of books on this issue called Everything from the Value in Ethics and Economics to Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives. We'll talk about her view of work. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Elizabeth Anderson. She is the John Dewey Distinguished University Professor of Philosophy and Women's Studies at the University of Michigan. She's the chair of the University of Michigan's Philosophy Department, and she was recently profiled in the New Yorker magazine as the philosopher redefining equality. And she's really, through decades of work, she's been asking us to rethink how we view the notions of liberty and equality in contemporary life. Professor Anderson, I was wondering if you could just kind of explain a little bit more about this new democratic model that you're advocating here, where we're shifting the ideas or the center of focus away from individual equality and liberty to a larger social one here. Because I see also, you know, in part of your work, you say that we need to move away from the idea of equalizing wealth, and that doesn't actually necessarily mean that people are equally free. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So part of my work has been a reaction against a certain trend in egalitarian theorizing, which has been, I think, obsessively focused with how much money or how many resources one person has in their pocket compared to another. And one of the difficulties I have with that is that it doesn't, that way of thinking about equality doesn't help us think about how those people interact in society. And that's the focus of my research. How do these people stand in relation to each other in society? Like if you just had billionaires on the moon who had no causal interaction with us, we wouldn't really have to care about that. differences in wealth do make a difference, but only as mediated through the relationships, the social relations through which money makes a difference. So if some people are billionaires and they can buy political candidates, well, those candidates becoming office holders then have an unequal impact on citizens. That creates an inequality among citizens, and that's something to be of concern. But the money just taken in isolation in itself doesn't really tell us a whole lot. We have to see how money operates to create power differentials. Mm. And that's what I'm concerned about tracing.
Well, so tell me more about that, because I see what you're saying about like on the billionaire side of things. But one question that popped up into my mind when I was reading through this part of your work is, you know, but what about for people on the impoverished side of the scale? I mean, how is it possible for them to be truly free if the lack of material wealth or material well-being becomes such a controlling force in their lives?
Oh, you're completely right about that. So everyone is going to need some basic level of access to resources in order to have a decent set of opportunities in society and to have some basic measure of freedom and also respectability. The great philosopher and economist Adam Smith pointed out that in his day, in 1776, an Englishman needed a linen shirt and leather shoes to be able to appear with respect before others in society. And so he claimed that, you know, workers need access to decent clothes so that they could appear before others, you know, with a sense of respectability. And that's, of course, no different today. We have different standards. And as society rises in prosperity, those standards go up. And that means that even the lowest paid worker is going to need enough pay to afford the goods that are required to appear with respect before others.
Well, so Professor Anderson, since you mentioned Smith here, let me just ask you, because part of your research and your thinking and your body of work involves looking at actual historical context, right? And so, you know, Smith, of course, with his invisible hand, is being seen as the patron saint of free market capitalism, which may have worked in his time. But you know, since then, we've had the Industrial Revolution. We're undergoing the technological revolution. You talked about how billionaires can consolidate power. I mean, do the basic theories that Smith provided that worked for his time, do they still fundamentally apply or are of benefit in our time now?
Well, Smith had a lot of things right, but of course he couldn't predict the future. So, and neither can anyone. Marx couldn't either. What Smith imagined free markets would deliver for ordinary people was simultaneously a form of freedom and a form of equality, because he imagined that a free market society with full competition would lead to a society of individual proprietors running their own businesses. Everybody would be self-employed. No one would have a boss. That is certainly an interesting image, a promising image of a free society of equals. Everyone is self-directing, running their own business. Nobody's taking order from anyone else. Unfortunately, that vision really didn't pan out because the Industrial Revolution brought about enormous economies of scale. And it turned out that the more efficient and profitable operations had lots of employees and bosses who were giving them orders within the firm. So although Smith advocated free markets on a certain basis, he couldn't really see in the future that the employment relation was going to be central to most people's lives. And consequently, he didn't really have a lot to say about how the employment relation would need to be reformed in order to secure the freedom of workers in that relationship. And that's where a lot of more recent thinking is needed, I think, to reform that relationship so that workers aren't totally oppressed under arbitrary orders of their managers.
Yeah. You know, I want to just take a little turn here and talk about another aspect of your body of work, because we've been focusing a lot on sort of the economic aspects that bind together freedom and equality. But you also, in 2010, you wrote The Imperative of Integration, because if we're going to talk about equality, especially in the American context, or inequality in the American context, we have to talk about race. So can you just give us in a nutshell what you wrote about in The Imperative of Integration, and how you see race playing a role in what your view is on how to balance freedom and equality?
Yes. So if you look after the abolition of slavery around the time of the Civil War, there was a brief period of Reconstruction that lasted about 10 years in which American society was actually trying to create a society in which blacks and whites would be equal. But the South fought back against that, and its main tool to destroy that image of racial equality was Jim Crow, systematic segregation. Whites self-segregated and monopolized all of the opportunities for themselves to acquire property, run their own businesses, have access to decent schools and so forth, and segregated out blacks to inferior schooling, inferior access to property, and radically constrained freedom in the South. So the way I analyze it, segregation, racial segregation, is really a linchpin of racial inequality. And even after the end of legal Jim Crow, we see that legacy has continued, not only in the South, but of course there was a lot of de facto segregation across the North as well, in housing, schooling, and so forth. And those inequalities have persisted through the generations. So on my view, to tackle racial inequality, we have to tackle that linchpin of racial inequality, which is segregation in all of its forms,
okay,
housing, employment, occupations, schooling, and so forth.
Okay. So if I, you know, I don't want to, I'm taking the risk here of summarizing a big body of work down into a couple of sentences, but do I hear you say, what you're saying is that you believe that integration can help advance equality. And so therefore,
yes.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes, right. So it's a pro-integration vision. I want to revive the vision of integration that propelled the civil rights movement, because I think it still has promise and it's something that we still need to be working on.
Yeah. So, Professor Anderson, stand by here for just a second, because this is a very interesting part of your work, and we wanted to get a response or a perspective on it. So we reached out to Lionel McPherson. He's joining us today from Medford, Massachusetts. He's a professor of philosophy at Tufts University, who co-directs the certificate program in ethics, law, and society. They're currently at work on a book called The Afterlife of Race. Professor McPherson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. I'm wondering if you could just give us sort of your response, your take to what Professor Anderson has, you know, written about specifically regarding her seeing integration as advancing the cause of equality in America.
Well, that approach has been tried, and I think we got the answer about 40 years ago by the late 70s that it failed, and it failed because white America on the whole doesn't support it. So from my perspective, segregation, racial segregation, is a manifestation of the problem. And the problem basically is that white America overall has been steadfastly unwilling to give up its socioeconomic privilege. So when we try to even voluntary integration measures, they tend to be pretty fragile, and they're dependent on white buy-in. And there hasn't been a lot of that buy-in. And even when there has been that buy-in, black and brown families end up being hostage to the whims and preferences of what the white community in question would prefer. So, for example, my family lives in an area that has, in Massachusetts, it has a regional high school. The bigger town, as part of that regional high school, decided to opt out of the voluntary busing program. Mm. And they did that with the rise of awareness and student protest concerning police violence that seems to be disproportionately targeted against or affecting Black and brown people. So that's a pretty fragile basis for anything like mutual respect, social relations, democratic equality, in that we're talking about relatively few Black students, even at a very large high school, and that was too much. So I just don't see, you know, the integration was only ever supposed to be a means to advancing racial justice. It had no special power on its own, and I would have thought by now it's clear that it's not going to be an effective means. And white America has been backed by the Supreme Court. So even voluntary busing programs, as the Supreme Court declared about 10 years ago, are no longer pass constitutional muster if they take race explicitly into account.
Right.
So I'm just baffled as to how Professor Anderson's proposed solution is supposed to work and how it grapples with the underlying problem.
So, Professor Anderson, let me turn back to you, because it seems as if Professor McPherson is saying that the theory bumps up against the reality of racism in America.
There's no doubt that there is a lot of racism in America, and we're actually going through a period now of enormous white backlash. But backlash is always in response to racial progress. And while Professor McPherson is correct that a lot of school integration was rolled back, we shouldn't forget the enormous successes that it did have when, in the period in the 1970s and early 80s, when Brown v. Board of Education was being vigorously enforced by the federal courts, there were enormous advances made in school integration in the South, and that corresponded with tremendous advances in Black school achievement and also significant improvements in the racial orientation or attitudes of white children. Racism was actually softening. Unfortunately, it was happening with the children much more than with their parents, who were consumed with preserving their privileges. But in fact, we see in the actual places where integration has succeeded and been stable, there are a number of cities where this has taken place.
I'd be very interested in knowing where they are. I'm not really that familiar with them, especially in the South.
Yeah, there are a few. Cleveland is a place where there are some places where this has happened. I can give you a list, but I don't have them at the top of my head. But what we do find is that it is possible to create successful, stable, integrated neighborhoods in which different races get along. Often these are cosmopolitan places where it's not just Black-white, but there are Latinos and Asians also involved. And I think that these are sources of really important knowledge about how to move forward and that this knowledge can be built on. Mm. Obviously, this takes an enormous struggle. Whites are not going to give up power and privilege easily. But notwithstanding all of the backlash, things are better today than they were in 1963. And I believe in moving forward. Yeah.
Well, Professor McPherson, we've got about a minute and a half before I have to take a quick break, but I want to give you one more chance to share one last thought here.
I would recommend that people take a look at the New York Times mapping segregation map. It gives a vivid and color-coded illustration of the extent of racial segregation actually across the country and major cities. And I really do not have any idea what great successes. Sure, if you set the bar at 1963, but if you set the bar at, let's say, 1978, We know that there has been that socioeconomic progress for Black Americans has been stagnant and has even started to reverse. So, you know, and I'm not denying that there's been progress made, because no doubt there has, especially if you go back to 1963 or 1954. But that progress has been by, as I'm publicly available socioeconomic measures, has been stalled for at least the last 30 to 40 years.
Hmm. Well, Lionel McPherson is a professor of philosophy at Tufts University, currently working on a book called The Afterlife of Race. Professor McPherson, thank you so much for joining us giving us your perspective on this. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Professor Anderson, stand by here for just a second. We'll come back from a really quick break. We're talking about Elizabeth Anderson's view of how to see equality as the fundamental basis for a truly free society. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Professor Elizabeth Anderson. She's the chair of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Michigan, and she was recently profiled in the New Yorker magazine as the philosopher redefining equality. And Professor Anderson, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. We've got some questions for you. So if I may, I just want to bring a couple of them in. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Winchester, New Hampshire. Mary, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. This is actually a good segue from what Professor McPherson was just discussing. So I'm a professor of social justice education. I do a lot of teaching and training and on these exact issues. And one of the things that we have been diving into more in our field is really sort of what I would call troubling the idea of equality. And we've been talking more about how do we engage with ideas of equity, given that we know there's a historical and sociopolitical context that's very much alive and well in our country, where the ground was set where certain groups had access to resources that allowed them to move through the system in a way that others didn't have that same access. Mm-hmm. And so I want to trouble the idea of equality, and I feel like actually it's a bit outdated, that what we really need to be talking about is equity. And I wonder, Professor, if you could talk a little bit about how you see the relationship or not between those two terms.
Mary, thank you for your call. Professor Anderson, go ahead.
So I'm not sure exactly how you're defining these terms, but sometimes people have thought of equality in a purely mathematical sense. That's what I was criticizing before, like just looking, if I have so many dollars in my pocket and you have the exact same number of dollars, then we're equal. And I think it's pretty clear that that's not a good account of equality, because some people have better ability, given the social relations in which they operate, to convert those dollars into useful things. A Black person, for instance, with the same number of dollars isn't able to get equivalent housing as a white person, because the real estate agents won't even show them all the housing opportunities that they – that all the housing openings that are there, and they might not even get rented an apartment that they could easily afford because the apartment owner is practicing racial discrimination. So on my view, equality has to be understood in relational terms. How are people relating to each other in society? Do some feel like they can treat another person with impunity because of their race or their gender or something like that, some identity that makes them subordinate? If so, then you don't have equality no matter how much money the two parties have. So maybe that's what you're thinking of when you think about equity, is that you're looking at how people are interacting. It's not just about who can give orders to who, but also is there a basic respect there, a recognition that the other party can make claims on them, that they can't just be despised or insulted for who they are? That's really fundamental to a society of equals.
But Professor Anderson, I think part of what I hear Mary saying and others with whom I've had similar conversations is that they would push back and say, no. We actually are speaking about equality in absolute terms, not relational terms. That when they speak of equity, they're saying, look, what we have to overcome is that there have been long, deep-seated institutional inequities in America between races, between genders, between social classes, and those are absolute. We can measure them, and so in order to produce a truly equal society now, those are the historical weights that we have to overcome, or the historical challenges we have to overcome through policies or institutions. That it's not relational; it's actually quite absolute.
Oh, well, what I would say here is that policies have to be designed to put people in a situation where they can relate as equals. Now, those are going to be structural. So if you think, say, about the workplace, what that means is bosses can't have untrammeled power to do whatever they like to employees and force them to suffer that on pain of getting fired. There have to be systems of accountability, some measures within which workers can have voice within the firm, make complaints without fear of retaliation. Right now, 80% of workers who complain of sexual harassment face retaliation at work. Obviously, there's an inequality here, an inequity here. If workers could actually have some voice in the governance of the firm, they'd be able to lodge their grievances and have an institutional structure in place where they wouldn't face retaliation for that.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Colchester, Vermont. Roger, you're on the air. Hi, Roger, you there?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have recently read several books on the Nordic theory of life. And the essence of that theory is equal opportunity. And healthcare and education are the basic necessities to be successful and to have equal opportunity. And we have in education, there's preschool, education through a doctorate. Everyone has health care for life. They also have long-term care. And so these ingredients provide everyone with equal opportunity to succeed.
Right, to level the playing field, right, from the get-go. Roger, thank you so much for your call. Professor Anderson, Roger's call brings me back to sort of where we started this conversation, and I'd like to hear more from you about America in particular today, because we sort of began the conversation with the presumption, and people can push back on it if they want, but with the presumption that in the United States we've long had this dichotomy where it's seen that people on the right would privilege liberty, perhaps individual liberty, over guarantees of equality, and people on the left would be seen to privilege equality over unfettered individual liberty, and that you're advancing a philosophy here that says no, those two aren't in tension, right? As I said at the beginning, that equality should be the fundamental basis for a free society. So what I want to ask you is, what do you think would need to change in American society now, as we see it, to bring about that kind of that nation or that culture that you've been writing about for so many years?
Well, it would take an awful lot, because in the United States today we have pretty extreme inequalities by class, by race, by gender. So a lot of things would have to change. But the things that I've been focusing on in my own research are, number one, how to promote equality in the workplace. And there, I think workers need a formal representation in the governance of the workplace. This is something that is common in the social democracies of Europe. It's known as co-determination. Workers have a formal place and a voice and a vote inside the governance of the firm. Senator Warren of Massachusetts has introduced a bill to require co-determination for the largest corporations in the United States. It's already a proven success model in places like Germany. No reason why we can't do that in the United States. The other dimension has to do with racial integration. Notwithstanding the great challenges that Professor McPherson has articulated into moving forward on that agenda, we do have proven success stories. And we do know that when integration does take place, that racial stigmatization goes down, and people of different races learn how to work together on terms of equality. So that is a vision. It's a possibility, but it's something that requires concerted effort and determined collective action to bring about.
It requires healthy institutions, right? Healthy systems, healthy forms of governance as well,
does
it not?
Yes, well, it requires the promotion of democracy across the board. One of the reasons why racial progress has been so difficult to achieve in the United States is that there are many aspects of our state and national constitution that are profoundly undemocratic. We see now massive gerrymandering in states such as North Carolina. If gerrymandering is just an attempt of a minority to entrench itself in power by redrawing the districts, if we had a more democratic system for drawing the district lines, North Carolina would be moving forward on a much more egalitarian agenda than is currently possible. And we can point to other states, too, which have been seriously gerrymandered. And of course, we also have a very flawed American constitution at the federal level that allows enormous amounts of veto points to minorities,
right,
which were, of course, have long been used very consistently to block advances in civil rights.
You know, in the New Yorker piece, it's written, quote, that Anderson suggests that citizens should fight to bolster healthy institutions and systems, those which ensure that all views and experiences will be heard, because today's righteous projects, after all, will inevitably seem fatuous and blinkered from the vantage of another age. Now, I think this is that's quite an inspiring call. But on the other hand, I'm wondering if it's even possible in this day and age, because I see sort of advocates on both the far right and the far left as seeing these very institutions we've been talking about as the means to advance ideologies. I mean, is it possible even to drain ideology out of the systems and the institutions that hold our society together?
Well, I would want to distinguish between partisan polarization and ideology. So people do need ideas to move forward. Mm-hmm. What you don't want is those ideas to stagnate into dogmas that people refuse to reconsider in light of new evidence and testimony from the voices of those who haven't been heard or listened to. But democracy, in its fullest sense, is a way for people to get together to solve problems that they face together, and that requires serious listening to each other and attention to reality, to facts. I think one of the crises that we're facing today is that policymaking is being made without regard to the facts. Fact finders, such as mainstream news media, are being disparaged, lies are proliferating, and you can't possibly build sound policy on the basis of lies and, you know, the spreading of fear and paranoia that is not based on reality.
You won't get any disagreement from me on that. but like, what is it? I mean, you've been thinking about this for decades, though. I mean, I'm leaning on your expertise and your body of knowledge here to sort of say, like, okay, well, how do we get ourselves out of this now? I mean, the very people you were talking about are the ones who hold the power now.
Yes, and so that's why we need concerted democratic organization. The institutions of democracy are under serious threat right now, but we have also seen that concerted collective action can change the system. But it requires enormous amounts of effort to overcome those obstacles. We have to move together precisely in defense of democratic institutions.
You know, in having this conversation with you this hour, I think some listeners might hear you and your ideas and the language that you use as coming from the left. And yet this New Yorker piece said that you're wedding ideas and values from both the left and the right together. So where does traditional conservative thinking factor in, or how does that factor in to this vision that you're advancing of liberty and equality?
So from the start, I've never given up on the idea that competitive markets are really critical to the establishment of a free society. And some aspects of the left are actually, for instance, the calls for more vigorous antitrust enforcement to break up monopolies and oligopolies. That actually is a pro-free market vision here. Mm-hmm. We saw Adam Smith arguing exactly the same thing. We need more competition of the big firms, and that would make them more accountable than they are present when they're tacitly colluding or have an enormous share of the market and so don't really have to pay attention to anyone. Time to break up those big firms. I take that to be a pro-free market position. And similarly, when it comes to property, we do need a system of private property. But we also need that system to be working for everyone. There are many, many different configurations of private property rights. The one we have right now is not, it's radically suboptimal. We can do a lot better, but that doesn't require the abolition of private property. I wouldn't go there. It's been tried. It's been a disaster. And so my view is not revolutionary, but it is very, very strongly reformist.
Mm-hmm. Well, Elizabeth Anderson is the chair of the University of Michigan's Department of Philosophy. She was recently profiled in the New Yorker magazine as the philosopher redefining equality. Just a very profoundly important question about whether we can be free if we're not truly equal. Professor Anderson, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And by the way, we have a link to that New Yorker article at onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoisch, Asil Kibbe, and Alex Pena. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.